It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast exploring all areas of the justice system, with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor.
In this episode, I speak to Sarah Beresford, Prison Reform Trust Associate and Churchill Fellow. Sarah is also the author of What About Me, a report which explores how children's lives are impacted when their mothers are involved in the criminal justice system. In this episode, Sarah describes how children are so often invisible to decision makers and explains how her recently developed child impact assessment can equip adults and services to listen more closely to the needs of those with mothers in the criminal justice system.
My name's Sarah Beresford. I'm an associate of the Prison Reform Trust and I'm also a Churchill Fellow. So I'm being funded by the Churchill Fellowship to work really closely with the Prison Reform Trust around child impact assessments for children with a mum in the criminal justice system.
Okay, and could you elaborate on what the child impact assessment is and why we need them?
Yeah, so I've worked for many years in the field of supporting children affected by imprisonment, and I've been really aware for a long time that we've talked about we need to recognise children, we need to offer them support, but there hasn't really been anything concrete. I think there's often been a what does that mean question lurking in the air. So I wrote a report for the Prison Reform Trust in 2019, I think, might need to check the date, 2018, 2019, around the impact of children with a mum in the criminal justice system. And it was really out of that I thought, what does this mean when we're making these recommendations for more support, we're saying children should be better recognised, but what would that look like? And it was one of the women in an approved premises here in Liverpool. She said, you know, you get victim impact statements. Why don't you have child impact statements? And it just kind of set off a light bulb in my head of, yeah, we need to have something that allows children to say how they're feeling, but really importantly, to be part of decision making around any support they might need.
Just on that, because I guess the differentiation of a victim impact statement is that a child can still be the indirect victim of a victim. Yeah. Exactly. Are you following me? And that, so therefore they need their own separate impact statements. Is that right? So if their mother, for example, was the victim of domestic abuse, sometimes the child doesn't get recognised at all.
Exactly. And, you know, children of people in the criminal justice system are the hidden victims, if you like, of crimes that they haven't committed, but they pay a very heavy price for in being separated. And particularly when it's mums, you know, that's a huge price to pay for children, all the grief and loss and all of that. And yet there's very little support and almost no recognition all the way along the journey. Nobody's asking the question, what about the children? What do the children need? And this was my way of giving people a framework, if you like, to do that, to say, well, hang on a minute, what about the children? What's the impact been on them and what is it that they need? So I got together with some children and young people because I'm a great believer of I can talk about people, but it's the people who've lived it themselves who really know it. So we got together and I said, what would that look like then? What is it you want people to ask you at the different stages? And we put together this really simple set of questions. They're open questions. We don't use any jargon. They're asking simply, and this came from the children and young people themselves, you know, how are you feeling? How are you doing? And they wanted those to be they wanted those to be separate questions because they said, you know, I might be feeling really angry and upset and missing mum, but actually doing okay. And a lot of them said to me, I don't want people assuming that everything's awful because of mum. I might be feeling upset. One girl said, because the dog died. And she said, I hate it when my teachers, everything's referenced about mum being in prison, and it isn't always about that. So they wanted those questions to be in there, but separately. How are you feeling? How are you doing? Are you coping? You know, how are you coping? And then, you know, what questions do you have? So just really asking open questions. Is there anything, what support do you feel you need? What is it that, who could help you and what could they do? And I think often when we're working with children and young people, we fear questions like that in case they ask for a CALMS referral, you know, children and adolescent mental health. And the kind of things that the children were saying to me was, I just want like an extra long phone call with my mum. I want to meet her in a room in the prison by myself because I want to tell her something private. Or one young woman said to me, you know, I watched my mum being arrested and it was really difficult and traumatic. And I wish that I had had an opportunity to speak to the police after that and tell them what that felt like for me. You know, so they're not, the children, young people are not asking for really high end, complicated, expensive interventions, as important as those often are. They're wanting really deliverable, doable things that we should be doing, but if we listen to them.
And then do you get to do the things that they want? So if they say, obviously having a room to themselves in a prison on visits is probably impossible. So how do you manage that?
So that is a really good question, Edwina, because not all of the actions will be immediately deliverable. But I think what's really important is that children feel their voices are being heard and they can express what it is they need. So what we're looking at is who does the child impact assessment with children. And I might come back to that around giving them a choice in that. And then that person very much focusing on the actions, but written in the children's own words. And I think whatever children say that they want, we can at least say, do you know what? Let's ask. Let's ask and let's look at that. And I think the more we ask and the more we prisons hear that message. I was in at an event in Northern Ireland yesterday, and one of the prisons there has exactly that, a small room where families can meet privately. Now, it's one room for a whole prison, but it's a start. And I think the more children are able to say, that's important to me, that's what I want, the more we can start addressing those. And I think we can be honest with children and say, this may not happen, but let's ask. And it's really important that you've said that that's what you would like. Children are not, you know, they're intelligent. They get it. They know it's a big complicated system, but it's the being listened to that's the bit I think is really key. And I think the more we do encourage them to speak out and ask for things that should be deliverable, the more we might have a slightly different justice system.
Okay. And at what point did you say, is it that this assessment might be done?
Yeah, so it's designed to track mum's journey through. So following her arrest, the point of her court and sentencing, going to prison or community sentence, and then prior to her release. So it's designed for those key times. It can be accessed, though, at any time.
OK, so someone in the police custody suite could write it, or someone in the magistrate's court could do it, or someone in the prison could do it.
Unlikely that those people would be doing the assessment, but we're not ruling that out. What we're saying to children and families is, who is it that you would like to do an assessment like this with you? But those people you've mentioned, so police, probation, prison staff, have a really key role in flagging it and saying to families, there is this assessment. Is that something that would be helpful? And then built into it is about giving children choice. So allowing them to choose who is the adult in their life that they would like to sit down with and talk about these things with. So it doesn't fit neatly into a set process or referral route, if you like, which is, I think, a huge opportunity and its biggest challenge, because I think it's everyone's responsibility to think about children. And what's happened is it's become nobody's. And what we're trying to say with this is, let's put it back on everybody's agenda. So what if following an arrest, the police said, you know, there are children in this house, there's a child impact assessment might be really helpful for them to talk about what's happened here. There's an organisation locally that provides that kind of support, or there may be someone at school that could help. Who is it? It's asking those questions, offering to families, and giving them the opportunity to be involved in that themselves.
Okay. So, for example, if a single mother was arrested and she had two kids, five and two, for example, and she gets taken to the police custody suite because she's been arrested, what happens to the children? I know I'm digressing slightly off your topic, but I guess it's related.
It's a really good question. At the moment, what happens is incredibly ad hoc. We hear stories often of children not being collected from nursery or school because mum just isn't there. That the police have very much focused, understandably, on the arrest, but haven't perhaps considered the children around. So at the moment, it's an incredibly ad hoc situation. Grandmothers often end up picking up the pieces, or family friends. And I'd like to see a better system where police, and it's not just about the police, but around arrest, where police are really thinking about the children and the impact and asking the question, is there someone that we could call or you could call right now about your children? Do they need picked up from somewhere? One woman in HMP Peterborough recently told me that she was arrested as her partner had already left the house, and the police didn't even let her phone him. The children were just left. Now, she created such a scene that they eventually let her phone her mother, who could come round, but it was not initially on their radar. And these children were, I think her son was 8 and her daughter was 10. Now, that is too young to just leave children in a house. That the police, have a duty of care there. And she shouldn't have had to, in her words, create a scene to achieve that outcome. It's going in and offering those things in a way that's preemptive rather than reactive.
Yeah, because surely, you know, what the police don't want is for people to be kicking off and causing a scene. So why would you not behave in a way that exactly. makes sure people don't have to behave like that?
Yeah, and it's just balancing, you know, the police have a really key role to play in arrests and they have pressures on them. But from the conversations I've had with police, they do want to be mindful. They don't want to leave children abandoned. You know, another story I heard was a child cowering under a bed while the arrest was taking place downstairs. It was obvious that there was at least a child in the house by the things that were around, but nobody asked. The arrest happened. She was 14. But still, that's very young to just be left cowering under a bed. And nobody asked at the point of arrest, are there children here in the house? Is there someone we could phone or you could phone to help look after that child? You know, that's not acceptable. And I think with the impact assessment, it's trying to get children onto everybody's radar. So we're all asking the question, hang on a minute, what about the children?
Okay. What stage is it at, or how long have these been in sort of circulation, if you like?
So I'm involved in the moment in a consultation process. What I'm doing is I've written it with children, and now I've circulated it far and wide for consultation, and people are feeding back to me. I've had some great responses from children and young people with lived experience, from mums, from practitioners who work with women and or children. I've been speaking to policymakers, and what I'm doing is drawing all that feedback together. And in October, I'm going to publish a toolkit, and that will have the revised impact assessment in it. Really importantly, alongside it are accompanying notes. And that's in recognition that the child impact assessment could be used by, for example, a teacher who hasn't had any training on the impact of imprisonment, you know, or doesn't understand women in the criminal justice system. So the accompanying notes are really key because they give background information. They make it really clear that trauma is often around, and a trauma-informed approach is absolutely key. They give points of reference for further resources. So in theory, the child impact assessment could be used by any adult in that child's life. And children are often telling me it's a teacher or a youth worker. I heard a wonderful story a few years ago, before this really became a concrete thing, but where a child wanted to speak to the dinner lady because he had a really good relationship with her. And I think that we need to listen to that. There's a child who... that nobody would have guessed that was the adult that really mattered to him.
None of us should be guessing. We should be asking, not guessing, because these children do have agency, and often it's the agency that's been taken away from them or that they've never had. And, you know, if they're able to talk, then they should be able to talk, and adults should be able to listen.
Exactly. And that's a really interesting point about being able to talk, because I'm also looking at how do you... assess the impact on very young children or children with learning difficulties. And there are ways of doing that where adults can step into their shoes. Midwives, you know, I've spoken to some midwives who say, you know, babies can talk if we just tune in and listen to their body language, and children with learning difficulties similarly. So I think, yeah, but absolutely, we giving them choice, giving them agency, listening to what they're saying. And we've had, you know, in this country, some tragic news stories of children who have died, whose mothers have entered the criminal justice system. They've gone into the care of other family members and they've died in the care of those people because we did not ask the question, what about the child? What about the impact on them? Is this suitable? We didn't ask. And it's that, it's, you know, saying, hang on a minute, and giving the child an opportunity to talk and to share and to say the difficult things. And I think at the heart of this for me, it's about laying aside any assumptions that we have and really listening to what that child is saying. So even if we think, oh, you're probably better off not seeing mom or whatever it is, that's irrelevant in the sense that it's about what that child is saying. Now, obviously, there are safeguarding measures that we need to be aware of, but we can still start by listening and asking children how they feel and then go on the journey of exploring with them about what where that might end up. Does that make sense? So it's really our starting point is, how are you doing? How are you feeling? What's going on for you here?
And as you say, this isn't just a criminal justice system thing, is it? So you said it could be used by teachers. So what if you had a particularly sort of, not a tricky child at school, but a child that was sort of being a bit challenging, might that be a time that a teacher might say, oh, I might just do a child impact assessment?
Yeah, well, so this impact assessment is designed specifically for children with a mother in the criminal justice system. I think it would have wider use. And the idea is that teachers are key people who may be completing it with children. But again, a lot of teachers say to me, you know, and I am a teacher in a former life. I used to be in teaching. And in fact, it was while teaching three children whose mum was sentenced to life in prison that I realised, hang on a minute, there is no training for teachers, there's no information. So I left education, jumped into criminal justice system because I thought, into criminal justice because I thought, we've got to do something here. And teachers are really, really key, and yet they're often saying, we don't know what to do, we don't understand the issues. And what the accompanying notes is an attempt to do is to say, you've got all the skills there, actually. We often fear it's to do with criminal justice, we panic, but actually the way we relate and understand to people is universal regardless of the issues.
Yeah, exactly. Did you say it's just for mothers who've gone into the prison, or is it fathers as well, or is it because the mothers are usually the primary carers?
So I'm starting this with mothers because Harriet Harman did an inquiry as part of the Human Rights.
Yeah, the Joint Committee on Human Rights, I think it was. Yeah.
And one of their recommendations was to better assess the impact on children. So there's been that impetus for a while of when it's a primary carer, there's even more reason to do this. But absolutely all children with a father or any family member in prison. So I've already begun adapting it for use. I'm liaising very closely with charities that work with families affected by imprisonment, and they very quickly said, we need this tool for children with a dad in prison. And so we're adapting it, absolutely. But the reason I focused on children where it's mum is because of that. If she's the one that's been there and looking after you, and even if you hadn't had contact with her before she enters the criminal justice system, what children said to me was, it's really difficult when it's your mum. It's there's something about that that makes it particularly hard. And I think that was my starting point. And also our sentencing guidelines quite clearly say if there are children, you know, if it's a primary carer, that can be taken into consideration at sentencing. And I think should be. But again, there's no way. What does that mean? Sentences. So the impact assessment would work beautifully in that context. So a pre-sentence report might flag that there are children. And you might get a little bit, in a good pre-sentence report, you might get a little bit of information about those children. But what women told me is you never get child-centred information about what they're really feeling and what the impact on the children is in the pre-sentence report. And often pre-sentence reports are scant anyway. But if a pre-sentence report were to trigger that there are children, probation staff could then say, actually, there's a child impact assessment here. Is there somebody that you would like to complete this with? And we can feed it into the sentencing information for that, for the magistrates or the judge. And that's, I think, so that whoever's doing the sentencing has a full picture.
Okay, so then the magistrate sort of opens the pre-sentence report on that day. It's clearly flagged that there might be one child in relation to this woman perhaps standing in front of them. But then they get a little bit of information about that child and how they're feeling and what the impact might be on them.
Yeah, and they understand that a custodial sentence is going to mean that child might have to move home and live with another family member. If there's a group of siblings, it might mean the siblings might need to be split up. What we're not saying is that the child impact assessment will influence sentencing. But I think there are many cases, especially those on the cusp, where it should be taken into consideration, and robust community alternatives are always going to be better. And we know that from the research. Short prison sentences don't work. They're long enough to disrupt a woman's life and her children's, and not long enough for any meaningful intervention. And I think for those cusp cases, absolutely robust community alternatives are better. And the child impact assessment can really flag those and give a fuller picture of what this is going to mean. What a 6-month prison sentence is going to mean for John, who's 10, and for Sam, who's 8. And I think for sentences to enter into that is really important, because it's not just the woman before them. It's her children come very much into that as well.
Exactly. I mean, I imagine one of the problems, and certainly one of the problems I hear from magistrates, is, well, look, you know, I'd love to give a woman a community sentence, maybe because of abuse they're suffering in the community at the hands of a man, be it an abusive partner, drug dealer, pimp. But actually, the community services that maybe were once there, maybe before the privatisation of probation, you know, they just simply don't exist. So actually, it's not a great option. But I feel like my only option actually is to send her to custody, which is a bit of a sad state of affairs that we sort of find ourselves in, isn't it?
I think it's hugely sad. I think the recent review of the female offender strategy highlighted the 9.5, and I'm not totally confident on my figures, but around 9.5 million for community interventions and, you know, 200 million for more prison places. And that says it there, right there, doesn't it? That absolutely we need to look at funding going into community provision, robust alternatives to custody, you know, meaningful interventions. And that's what I think, there's often a fear among policymakers and government about how the public might react. And actually, the public wants safer communities.
Exactly. It's the thing I always talk about, which is often if we want a desired outcome, and we are all the same in the fact that we want to live in safer communities, you know, we want to feel safe ourselves when we're out late at night, and we all want the same outcome, we know therefore how we need to treat people, and actually we know what we need to do to sort of help people become less violent and all the rest of it. But it's unpalatable to some people to help those that need to become less violent and to put the money into those things. But it's like, but it's the right thing to do. So it doesn't matter whether it's unpalatable or not. It is, you know, what the evidence says we should be doing. And that's where the investment should be going. And it really irritates me that it always comes down to the political point scoring, like, let's smash a load of money into building prisons, and then all the red tops and the voters will go, well, hey, you know, and it's, we know it doesn't work.
Exactly. And I think it often feels unpalatable to people when they think about it in the general, you know, so people in prison. But when they hear Joan's story, you know, who had 4 children and who got a 4-year prison sentence when she'd been living in a, you know, in a relationship of domestic abuse, you know, they most people really feel that and get it. And I think for me, it's about helping people enter into the stories of those, and included in that is their children as well. What's the reality, the impact when your mum is sentenced to prison? And it's enormous. And I think even the coldest of hearts, when it comes to the children who have not committed any crime whatsoever, they do begin to get it. And I think there's something for me about this, is definitely, I'm hopeful that it's a way in for people to say, yeah, actually, we do need to do something for children in and of their own right, because, as you exactly said, Edwina, it's the right thing to do. And we need to move away from that really unhelpful message of, we need to support children whose parents are in the criminal justice system so that they don't go there too. That's a damning, unhelpful, you know, negative message that just destroys young people. They get really upset about that. And actually, I've met some extraordinary young people who've risen above the most difficult of situations with the right support. That's the key, isn't it? And I think that's what this is attempting to do, to say, you know, you have a right to support, and you have a right to be a part of what that looks like, to be able to say, I don't want to, I want to write a letter to mum to tell her how I'm feeling, or I want to, yeah, have that extra visit in the prison, whatever it is, a right to be listened to for those things that really matter to those children.
And how long did you say you'd been working on this?
So, I mean, it's been percolating away. So officially from last August, it'd been percolating away before that. But and then we're going to publish the toolkit in October. And that's going to be, I hope, what I felt was, nobody needs another report saying all the things that we already know with a set of recommendations that have already been written to a group of people who've already read them and not implemented them.
Just with a different date on them.
With a different date, exactly. You know, and I find that really disheartening sometimes, if I'm honest. So I've moved away from a report and realised that what would be really helpful is a practical toolkit for partnership groups like Women's Alliances, local authorities, PCCs, criminal justice boards, who often have strategies that say this, you know, reduce women's offending, increase support for children. But they don't have a, well, what does that mean? They don't know how to do that. And my toolkit, I'm hoping, is going to answer that question, at least in part, you know, be practical. This is how we can better support children. This is a way of doing that. These are some practical considerations. Here are some resources. I made a podcast with children and young people a few weeks ago, speaking about their experience and their thoughts about probation. And we played it at an HMPPS Think Child campaign just last week. The impact was extraordinary because these were young people. It sounded like we'd scripted it. I had to say to them, we did not script this. They said, you know, I think probation staff need better trained and they need to understand what it's like for us. One young man said, I want to meet a probation officer. If he's making all these decisions about my dad, I want him to know and understand what that means for me. You know, everything they said was amazing and spot on because they're living it. And so the toolkit will have resources like that in it, a podcast, possibly a little video that people can access that will support the work that they're doing, but very much focus on the how do we do this? Not a little bit, of course, about why we need to, but we know that, but how?
And how are you going to cascade that information? How are you going to make sure that it's disseminated to, you know, the people who are doing the child-centred policing and the sentences and the... What's the plan there? Yeah,
that's a really, really good question. So that's where PRT is really, the Prison Reform Trust is great on that. So they're really great at those channels of dissemination. And already I've had lots of meetings with interested groups and PCC groups and local authorities and criminal justice boards around the country. So they're all kind of primed and waiting, which is great. So we'll start there and we will shout loud about it. And we'll get the children, young people to do that as well. And built into the tool will be ways of evaluating it as well. So that and I'm going to be suggesting that we start small. You know, let's start small with what works and then build from there. Let's not try and aim to change the whole justice system by next March. But if we start small with existing relationships, and we know that that's what works, relationships, trust, partnership, integrated services, in a way that families don't have to keep repeating their story, you know, how we exactly share information, all of that will be reflected in this toolkit.
I always find if you do that bit properly at the beginning, which feels like it's slow, but actually it's so important. You have to be methodical. You have to start small and then it will snowball if it's effective and start really motoring.
It's one small thing, isn't it? As you well know.
Well I wasn't going to say that myself, but as you did.
But it's exactly that. And I think I come back to the children again, and often what they ask for in terms of actions is one small thing. You know, they're not really complicated. They'll say things like, I really want Mr. Jones at school to know what's happened. That's their one small thing. But yeah, they want to be part of that. They want to be there when Mr. Jones, they want to tell him themselves, but they might want someone to support them in that. It's making sure that we include children meaningfully in the support around this. So we're not writing, you know, memos to the whole school to say, you know, Johnny's dad's been in prison, which is what children really fear. We're sitting down with them and saying, who would it be helpful for you at school to know what's happened? And they'll often say, you know, not the whole school, but Mrs. Smith. I really like her. I know her and I trust her. And it's that one small thing. And then we go from there. And once, you know, that's established, then maybe someone else might need to know. But it's that. It's one child at a time, one step at a time, one small action at a time.
Yeah. Well, all power to your elbow. And I'd love to stay in touch to hear how it all goes when it hits the ground. But thank you so much for talking to me today and informing us a bit more about what is a really incredibly important piece of work.
Thank you very much, Edwina.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.